Good morning, David Haldeffer. How are you? This is Life Talk with Marietta from New York calling you. How are you?
I'm good. How about yourself?
Oh, not too bad. Thank you for asking. Before we get started, David, I'd like to introduce you to our audience because it's important to your background. That's what we're going to talk about today. David is a school psychologist of 40 years. Of course, he's retired now for a couple of years. And David has a bachelor's and a master's degree in school and clinical psychology. And he also a monthly contributor to the HealingMindMagazine.com. And thank you for making the time today, David.
Sure.
Yeah. I have several questions for you today because 40 years of working as a school psychologist, you have a wealth of knowledge to bring to the table, and I like to talk about that, how things were 40 years ago and what you were able to implement, what you actually worked on, what you saw, and also how you see things today, because we really need help today.
Sure. Wow, so we have to go way back in time to when I began.
Yes.
But when I started working in the schools, I actually worked as a special education resource teacher back in 1974. And Baltimore City had just gotten a special funding to put special education resource teachers into the schools, so they hired 200 of us and sent us out into each of the schools, and it was quite a experiment. And but at the same time, the United States was just first recognizing a new disability category called specific learning disabilities, SLD. So I was also in the process of getting my master's degree in school psychology at the same time. And so one of the things that it gave me the opportunity to do was to actually work with kids who had learning disabilities while I was getting a degree in school psychology. And I also worked with preschool children in a program in Baltimore City as a research associate. So we looked at kids ages 3 to 5, and I did that for a couple of years until I got the degree. And then my first 2 years, I actually went over to West Virginia and worked in 3 counties in 26 different schools for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then that really gave me a really wide range of experience, because some were two-room schoolhouses way back in the sort of the boonies. But it was quite an incredible experience, because I was in, you know, a small city like Wheeling, West Virginia, but also a very, very small town like Ameling, West Virginia.
How about Bakely?
Uh-huh.
How about Bakely?
What? Yeah.
Were you in Bakely as well?
No. I was up in the upper panhandle, Wetzel, Marshall, and Ohio County.
Oh, okay.
It was called RESA 6, Regional Education Service Agency. And I did a lot of workshops in the evening for parents, and I did workshops during the day. But a lot of it was testing and evaluation. And in those days, PL 94-142, the public law that I first came out and said that we had to get out there and identify the children with specific learning disabilities, came out. So there was a pretty big demand, even for trying to find a common definition across the board, because some people were looking at these children as having processing deficits, and others were looking at whether or not they had a severe discrepancy between their ability and their achievement. And then the next area that kind of came along after specific learning disabilities was attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And that started with looking at children that might have minimal brain dysfunction, and then they changed the name to the hyperactive child, and then it came out as attention deficit disorder, and then attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So they said there were three types, actually: inattentive type, hyperactive impulsive type, and combined type. So that sort of stayed in place my last 20 years or so. And so those kinds of kids were referred every week in the schools for evaluation and testing. And then, of course, before I was ever even a school psychologist, one of our first jobs was to identify children who might have mental retardation, or now they call it like mild intellectual disability or disorder. And then the big area I think that I finished up with was kids with emotional disabilities, which I think gets to your point about where the big problems are right now in the schools, the children with severe anxiety disorders and severe depression, especially in high school, but we see it as early as elementary school.
You know, you just brought up a very interesting point, David, because I have a podcast interview next week with Dr. Gilbert, and it's all about anxiety in youth. And
what
a powerful podcast that would make, including you, with your experience. That's incredible. But I know you're retired. I'm not pushing you.
Well, one of the things that I started doing workshops on was what we called when ADHD is not ADHD. And what happens is a lot of children with severe anxiety problems look very inattentive in class. And then they inadvertently sometimes get identified as having ADHD or ADD, when in reality they have an anxiety disorder and it's sort of unidentified, or it's not identified properly the first time.
Well,
so differential diagnosis is really important with those kinds of kids, because
yes,
you don't want to give that child an ADHD medication because it'll have the it'll cause more anxiety.
Right. Now, David, in the 60s, I probably would have been diagnosed as
ADHD.
ADHD, sorry about that. That's a new one. That's another one that's coming up. The anxiety I had moving from class to class daily when I didn't do my homework. So I had extremely anxiety, hoping that the teacher wouldn't ask me for any solutions, because if I had done my homework, it wouldn't have been a problem. But I kind of, the last 3 years, 4 years of my school life, I didn't do homework. So also, a lot of subject I wasn't interested in. So,
I think you and I in those days had those kinds of issues for anxiety, but today I think it's multiplied by 10, because these kids are more worried about what are kids saying about me on social media. They're worried about being bullied, or, you know, things being said about them on Facebook or Instagram or wherever they are. And I think they come to class so anxious about their social standing in school, or anxious about the divorce at home that's going on, or anxious about all kinds of things that we didn't have to deal with quite so much. I mean, the least of their problems is not doing their homework now.
Yes, because, well,
they don't even have homework a lot of times.
David, at that time, there were consequences. Severe shaming in front of the class, which gave me a total blockage later in life, in my early 30s, when I was working in a career as a finance broker and I had to give workshops and talk in front of people, and I couldn't. I would know and own the subject, but as soon as I would stand in front of people, I would almost like it's gone. I blacked out. I couldn't function anymore till I got that rectified. I recognized that. And if I had not done that, where it came from, the childhood. And it was a continuous shaming in front of the class by the teacher, because I didn't do the homework. I couldn't give them solutions because I had no idea about the subject. And it wasn't of interest to me either. So,
it only takes one teacher to really destroy a person, doesn't it?
Yes. They
you
were
can have
tough.
Six good teachers and one will destroy you by himself.
Because, David, they were tough. You couldn't go home to the teacher, the priest, and there
right.
were a few other authorities. You couldn't come home and said, oh, the teacher did such and such, and then mom and dad would show up the next day, you know, in school. That just didn't happen
Another interesting point you're making, in a way, is that I think there was a time, and I can't give you the exact dates on this, I'd have to look it up on the internet, but more than half of the states had something called corporal punishment, which meant that they could actually take you into a room, like the principal, take out a paddle, and in some cases a paddle with holes in it, and hit you like 20 times on the butt for misbehaving. And I saw that in West Virginia those first 2 years where I was testing youngsters in one room and the principal was paddling the kid in the other room, and my kid would like jump out of his seat every time that kid got hit with it. So you talk about anxiety. Imagine coming to school and loving school and coming back the next day after being beaten.
No, I am totally against that. I grew up and in Germany, as you know, I was born, raised, and educated there, and the school system was really bad in the 60s. I learned about that much later as an adult, so I could understand it. But also the adults in the mass mind, they had no use. I'm talking about the mass mind. They had no use for children. Children had to perform. It didn't matter from a this is how stupid some of the adults were. The little kids from very early on, even as a little baby, they had to perform. They couldn't cry too long. They couldn't do this. They couldn't do that. Otherwise, they would be punished. And people were beating their children. That's how I grew up.
Well, you know, I'll tell you another issue that's somewhat similar was when I first got my job, that people of all different disabilities were sometimes being housed in special schools. And so one day they asked me to go in as a psychologist and evaluate a student who is now like 16 years old, and he was in one of these special schools, and all around him were kids who were basically mentally retarded and had physical disabilities, and he had cerebral palsy. So I couldn't give him the performance side of the test. I had to give him the verbal part of the test. And he had 118 IQ. He was almost in the gifted range, so to speak, but he was very, very bright. And so I went to the superintendent of schools in that county, and I said, we got to get this youngster out of that school. He doesn't belong there. And we had the first, like, he hired an aide, a teacher aide for him, full-time to push the wheelchair. And we got him into this new consolidated school that they had in Wheeling, West Virginia. And he just had a smile from ear to ear. And, he, you know, it was really in those days we were trying to get the first steps toward inclusion and trying to get kids with disabilities back into the regular schools so that they could be with the other students, you know.
Just,
so I felt really good about doing that back in 76 or 87,
And another thing, what I saw documentaries of much later, because YouTube is a wonderful classroom for all interested, you know, how kids, and I'm talking about specifically in Germany in the 60s, if they spoke up, and it's normal to speak up. Why not speak up? I'm encouraging everybody to speak up if they don't.
Look at Greta, she's speaking up. Greta Thunberg.
Yeah.
You know, the climate girl.
They were punished. They were labeled as difficult children, and they would go into institutions.
Right.
You know, that is a whole nother talk show, that whole era.
Well, you know, you say Germany, but you know, the Milgram studies talk about how we are taught to be obedient. And in Germany, that was a very important thing, that children be obedient. And that's the reason the whole Nazi thing came about, was because people were taught to be so obedient to authority. And, of course, schools do that. They, you know, you must obey the teacher, you must obey the principal, you must obey the... So it's hard to learn to question authority. It's hard to learn to say, no, I'm not going to do that, when you get punished if you say, no, I'm not going to do
that. Yes. And much later, when I went back to Germany in the late, well, it was 1990, I worked there for 10 years, and I worked with younger and older generations. And anybody under 30, they have a total, they don't belong, they have no mass mind mentality. They go against authority, and the older generation, it's starting to break a little bit, but they still have that authoritative obeying, whether they go to the IRS or whatever, local municipalities and so forth. Even a doctor still, you know, they look at, their kings or whatever you want to call it. It's just, no, I never conformed with that mentality, and I didn't like it. So I have a problem, big problem with that. So, which brings me over to, nor did the adults have any connections to the children. And we weren't taught how to learn, how to experience life from little on.
Just as a side point here, my son went to German kindergarten when we were over there, and the nice thing about it was they had two teachers in a small classroom, maybe 20 kids, and then, you know, one afternoon a week, he would come home because the teachers worked together to plan everything. I think there was a treehouse in their room. They had a lot of activities that went on, and they did a lot of, like, walking field trips and stuff. And I really felt like he got a fantastic experience with two of the best teachers I've ever seen. And then they had him for 2 years, the same two teachers. So, you know, and this started like ages 3 to 5. And we don't have kindergarten in America from 3 to 5. And so I really think they're ahead of the game when it came to humanistic type of learning pre-school age, I guess you'd say. I think that the way it's set up with the gymnasium and and the other things, they really require you to work really, really hard in order to get to the academic high school.
Absolutely.
And you have to pass exams, and it's very competitive.
And you know what I think, too? I think you lived in Bremen. Was a much larger city than where I grew up. I grew up in Fulda, which is between Frankfurt and Kassel.
My son went to school down there by Kreuznach when we were down there. Yeah, he went to a little school near there.
That's not far from Fulda, but Kreuznach. Not far from it at all.
Near Wiesbaden,
And what I want, that's quite a distance. Wiesbaden and Fulda, that's quite a distance. What am I, maybe I'm confusing it. But anyway, I think it had something to do with whether you grew up in a larger city and surroundings or a smaller city. And Fulda at the time was hardly on the map. It was known for being very Catholic, and so forth. So I think that has something to do with it also. I really do. You know, as far as what they're offering. But still, the mentality of adults, they were not for little children. That is my personal opinion and experience. So, and going forward now 40 years, having learned myself over all my adult life, how important it is, people that work with children, such as teachers, how important it is that they themselves have an understanding about emotional intelligence, have an understanding, or people in general have an understanding about their own feelings and thoughts. So there,
absolutely.
Yeah, this is what the core of today's topic is about. And David, I have to tell you, I have seen an experienced therapist that don't quite have that. I've seen professional people that work with doctors, that work with adults, children, and they just don't have it. Or HR, for instance, you know, they just don't have it.
Well, this is just my opinion, but I think that there are, that the great, great majority of teachers that I've worked with over the years are absolutely fabulous people. They have people skills. They love the kids they're working with. My wife, who had my kids, not my current wife, but my wife was a third grade teacher when we were in Germany, and she teaches first grade now. She just loves kids. And I think that the important thing for teachers that love kids is to, they do have that self-awareness, you know, being able to understand themselves as a part of the whole classroom environment. And then they are very kind of accepting of others, and they have a lot of gratitude for the parents that support them and support their kids. And they, so I really have had wonderful experience, but the more I liked teachers, the more they appreciated me. It was a very mutual thing when I was in the schools,
mm-hmm.
because some teachers would have real bad experiences with school psychologists, and I'd come into the school and they'd say, wow, you're so different, you know, because you really understand, you really are listening to us, you really care. So it's real important for a school psychologist as well as a teacher to be, have emotional intelligence too. There are a few psychologists who have turned off many a teacher over the years.
Go ahead.
It's important to be a good person.
yes, absolutely.
Empathetic.
But there are teachers, there are adults that just had a very tough upbringing too,
and that
was just not their priority to develop, if you will, and they're at certain key positions. And a friend of mine, Professor Christopher Kuk, K-U-K-K, he wrote the book, The Compassionate Achiever, How Helping Others Fuels Success. And it's really about teaching the children emotional intelligence within the classroom. And from what I understand, some of the schools throughout the United States, I don't have any data on it, but there are several schools throughout the United States that want to implement programs like that. I don't have any latest news on it, David.
I worked with several school systems that used a program called the Study of Teaching, and they would be doing a lot to help teachers become better teachers. You know, it was like an in-service program that went on for a couple of years, and they would be taken out of the classroom and taught how to be a better teacher. And then this was sort of a research-based, proven model of becoming a more empathetic, more, you know, emotionally intelligent teacher, as well as getting, you know, more successful results academically, which is what all the teachers want to do, is to have their kids learn to read better, do math better as well. But the counselors that I found in the schools really did a good job of going into classrooms and doing like a counseling unit on a certain topic, like bullying or any major topic that you might think of, like just understanding your feelings. And they would develop these feeling boards where they would have the kids just write 50 feelings on, and then how to talk about your feelings and how to use reflective listening skills and eye messages and things like that.
Exactly, David. Talking, really looking at what are you feeling now. They should start that at home, because I know families where the mother and father have a hard time articulating themselves. They don't talk about feelings or about thought, nothing. And, you know, the two children are just like that. They cannot communicate even the simplest thing, and certainly not how they feel or what they think. It's like an excavating job has to take place when you ask them any questions. It's incredible.
Yeah. Well, even two people who are really good at communicating with others can have trouble communicating with each other. That's why we have a high divorce rate.
You know, I was thinking it. I said, you said it. You were seconds faster than me being able to say something. I couldn't. When I was younger, I thought, I can communicate. I don't have a problem. Of course, I could talk a lot. But the content of what I said emotionally, on the emotional level, was not that great. Let me just tell you. So I learned much later in life what it means to communicate how you feel, how you think, what you want, what you don't want. But you just don't realize that when you're younger. You know, you just don't have that knowledge. You don't have a total picture. How could you? Because in your 20s, you're not that interested. I wasn't that interested in reading self-help books. I had other areas of interest, such as reading.
And I think sometimes we fear what the other person, how the other person's going to react. Like if I say, you know, really, I feel very angry when you, well, you might be afraid to say that because the other person might not understand what you're saying and how they might react to what you're going to say. So a lot of times we'll, like, keep our feelings to ourselves in fear of how the other person might react to how to our sharing of it, you know?
Yeah. For people that are interested in all of, you know, self, personal growth, everything, I'm going to have to ask you as a professional, how can we learn to get in touch with our feelings, our emotions? How can we learn? I would like to hear it from you as a professional, not from me, you as a professional.
Like, how can we learn it?
Yes, because a lot of people, you know, they're in their adult years, and they wouldn't know where to start. And, I mean, I know the path, but I'd rather have you say it, David, and then I'll chime in too, of course.
Well, I think the most important thing is listening skills. In other words, a person has to listen to others to sometimes find out about self. And to the degree that we're willing to accept what people have to say, and we can internalize what people have to say, the more we will understand ourselves and what's going on. And not to just, oh, I'm not going to listen to that, or, you know, move on. You have to really be willing to accept what people are saying to understand the feelings that you have. Or if you have somebody who's really close to you, whether it's a counselor, a spouse, a friend, that you can talk to, being able to have an ongoing relationship with somebody who's willing to give you good feedback about how you're feeling. If you say, oh, I'm feeling really sad about this, and if they can listen to you and you can listen to them, that kind of a relationship, I think, establishes the ability to understand our feelings a lot better.
Absolutely.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely,
okay.
David. Reflection. Through reflection, I have learned, especially when things didn't work out on a personal level, also on a career or job level, I have reflected in that area really always. It's like, you know, really doing my homework. And I have to say, even at my age now, I never do the same mistake twice. I have mastered that one. I mean, I still make mistakes, but not the same.
So, well, that's good.
Yeah. So, but, no, I'm very conscious about all of that. And as I was going in my 30s, I would also start getting self-help books where they were written in form of storytelling and case studies and so forth. And I could see myself in certain stories, people's life stories. And I said, this is what this means and that means and so forth. So, and then, of course.
That's interesting. That's exactly the technique we use in the schools with children who have Asperger's, where we tell stories and they learn social stories on how to behave based on the story that they're reading.
Wow. Okay. But the listening skills, of course, that's not being taught in school, in elementary school.
Yeah, it is.
It is?
It is. That's what the counselors, like in Montgomery County where I work, every counselor's responsibility is to teach the kids listening skills from grades K to 5. Yeah, that's a biggie.
I did not know that.
Well, it might not be done in every school in America, but it is done where they have the funding to have elementary school counselors. It's being done if they have that in their school. So maybe it's being done in wealthier counties across the country.
I see. How about interpretation of the spoken word? When you have a group of children or adults, the interpretation of the spoken word is different.
That's probably done in smaller groups when teachers refer kids to the counselor to say, this youngster really needs some extra help because he's reacting poorly in the situations in the classroom. And so the counselor will work either with that child individually or will put him in one of her groups, something like that.
I see.
That was my experience most recently at an elementary school, like 3 or 4 years ago. We had a fabulous counselor.
The interpretation. What advice would you have, David, for parents today? Parents that are raising children, you know, everybody is busy and they spend, you know, not enough time with their children and really leave it up to the teacher to bring social skills to that student, and it's not really their job. So what would you say to a family today, to mom, dad, what they should do, what the right thing is to do?
Gosh. Well, I raised two boys, and, of course, as a dad, I mean, I tried to do everything possible I could do with them, like all the sports, because they were boys and everything, and then, you know, I would do Cub Scouts, I would do, you know, everything after school. If they had a fun run at school and the parents could participate in Halloween or something, I would go on the pumpkin run with them. So whatever you can do to support PTAs, but if you have a concern about your child, I think you should go to the school counselor. Don't be afraid to sit down with the teacher. If the teacher suggests something, you know, do it. You know, don't argue with teachers. Teachers sometimes, not afraid, but sometimes parents come in and they're angry or they're threatening, and that's not a good place to start.
Exactly.
The best place to start is to go in and say, you know, I want to listen to the teacher. I want to listen to the counselor. I want to hear what they have to say. And then, you know, take notes. Most counselors will give parents lots of things to do at home, lots of ideas. Teachers will give plenty of ideas. And then it's up to the parent to really go home and work on those ideas. And, you know, there's just tons of great stuff out there nowadays compared to 40 years ago for parents to help their children. I used to give out a lot of things too to parents when we would sit down and talk.
So the counselors are really the ones to talk to really to really reach the parents, because it's very tough to tell the parents anything today, because what they could improve on. It's very, very difficult, and it's a very fine line subject too, you know, because everybody, they don't want to be told what to do, you know?
Yeah, I think they're pretty busy these days.
Yes, to put it mildly. I know I've always listened to the teacher, and so forth, and made adjustments, but I could have done better as well if I had been aware. So
Right. Today
we have all the support all around us. There is no reason why a parent can say, I need to improve myself. So that's really what I want to hear from people, because, hey, we're just because you're a parent doesn't mean you're doing everything right. And I want to do things right. You know,
right.
And
exactly.
I have had an opportunity with my grandchildren, Max 16 and Sophie 17. I have made things good with them versus with my daughter, where things were on the younger side on my part. And so it's all life. Everybody goes through that. But I'm all for educating everybody, and I cannot thank you enough for you taking the time today. There's so much more that you can share with the world, really, and with parents and the audience. So I can't thank you enough, David, for today. And
anytime.
You know. So for today, we're out of time. I want to thank you.
Okay.
And please let's stay in touch, David. Thank you very much.
Sure.
You take care.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.